Please join me in prayer, O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Dearest Mother,
Saints and Sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles,
and give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Amen. We have a lovely new journal out, so please take one before you go. Reading from the journal, In Memoriam, Premanad Trikanad. This is my writing. Our dear friend Prem Trikanad, grandson of Swami Ram Dass, has left the body. Prem and his wife Sheila lived for over 30 years near San Diego, California. In later years, they returned to India, living in Pune, east of Mumbai. Their son Deepak and his family continued to live in the U.S. On several occasions, we were guests at Prem's house for their Thursday night bhajan. There is a special room built onto the back of their beautiful home that was dedicated puja room. The room was the width of the house, had high ceilings with pictures of saints suspended from above. In the corner was a large and colorful display of Papa and Mataji's pictures along with many other saints. The room had a powerful spiritual charge. On these occasions, Marge, Rani, Larry, and Kate and I were invited for dinner beforehand. Sheila was always the ultimate host, preparing the most delicious Indian dinner before the music program. She had a delightful sense of humor and was as lively as Prem was quiet. She said, "The only thing harder than being a saint is living with one." After dinner, devotees began to enter the house, many Indians and a few Westerners. Most brought some food with them that would be contributions for prasad to be taken at the end of the music program. In the corner opposite the altar with Papa and Mataji's pictures, Prem sat at electric keyboard or the harmonium. Deepak played the tablas, and Sheila, as a vocalist, sat in front of a microphone. Prem sang with such devotion, with a beautiful, melodious voice filled with divine love. The music program was varied. As others indicated, they would like to sing some devotional chants. They would make their way to the microphone set up for guests. The emphasis was on listening to the singing, although some of the music enlisted the voices of all. In Prem's presence, one felt his saintliness. He had such a sweet smile and was the picture of humility. It was while he was singing and I was wrapped in meditation in the back of the bhajan hall that I felt a tremendous revelation. I was to leave my profession and live only in service to God and Gurus as his minister. The thought had never entered my mind to take such a step, and it definitely changed my life in ways I could not imagine at the time. It is very interesting that God should choose the timing for giving me this direction at that moment, in the surcharged environment while Prem was singing. Through the years, Prem has been with us through his music. His slow version of Ram Nam I named The Only Song There Is, in honor not only of Papa and Mother's emphasis on this chant, but also the beautiful way Prem brings it alive with such heart and uplifting devotion. It is said that the angels in heaven sing songs of praise to the infinite while enveloped in bliss. It is easy to think of Prem playing his harmonium, his voice and music resonating throughout the universes, powerfully lifting one and all to new heights and beauty. May Papa, Mataji, and Swamiji ever bless Prem, as I know they have. Sri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram, Om. And a tribute also by Lois Hickenbottom. When first meeting Prem and Sheila, we had no clue as to who they really were. We just followed a lead from Peter Schultz. Jerry and I had never felt so welcomed to anyone's home as we were when we arrived at their home for satsang. The joy and bliss in their satsang room was so overwhelming to me that it was very difficult to contain tears. Prem's dedication and service to God was so great that he and Sheila turned the largest room in their house into the satsang room. The vibration was amazing. Pictures of many saints were everywhere, inspiring all who entered. To be uplifted in God and Spirit alone was the sole purpose of this home. What dedication to God! Prem, in my humble opinion, was pure humility and love, and being in his presence was joy itself. I am certain that his family misses him very much, and our greatest love goes out to his family. Prem and Sheila are two people who have left a lasting impression on me personally. Witnessing their love and service to God is without one of the greatest experiences I have had. And a tribute by Kate Kohler. I remember the first time I met Premanand and Sheila, around 1996-97. David, Marge, Larry, and I were visiting them at their home in San Diego. And when we walked in and were greeted by Premanandaji, I began to cry. Prem is Swami Ram Dass' grandson, and when I saw his shining face, it was like Papa was standing before me. How blissful it was to spend time with them, to experience the warmth of their hospitality, and to attend bhajan in their home. Sheila's and Prem's selfless service gave me my first glimpse of what it would be like at an ashram. Some time before, Larry had visited their home with Marge when he was in California for a business trip. He had brought back recordings of Prem singing Om Shri Ram. Listening to these changed forever my relationship with the sacred mantra. It went from being something I chanted occasionally to being an integral part of my life and spiritual practice. In 2003-2004, Prem and Sheila were at the ashram the same time I was there. I remember we were doing continuous Ram Nam for several days. All of us were divided into groups and chanted for two-hour blocks throughout the day and night. Harmoniums and tablas were brought into the mandirs. The sessions with Prem's group were especially uplifting. At Christmas time, Prem joined some of us Westerners who were practicing carols to sing in the bhajan hall on Christmas Day. When my daughter Nicole was at the ashram during that time, she was particularly taken with Prem, and he was kind enough to arrange a trip to Mangalore so they could pick up her friend at the airport. The last time I saw Premanandaji was also at Anandashram in December 2007. He had arrived with his son, daughter-in-law, and grandson. Sheila was not well enough to travel down from Pune. We were all having satsang with Swami Satchidananda in the centenary hall, and everything stopped when the family arrived and we walked up the center aisle to pranam to Swamiji. There was an air of celebration having these three generations of Papa's family there. But of course, Prem never sought or expected any kind of attention. He was the humblest of souls. I was at the ashram this year when our dear Prem left the body. There was some sadness and a lot of concern for Sheila, who had loved and served him for so long. But most devotees expressed gratitude that Papa had released him from bodily pain and discomfort. Swami Muktananda spoke to everyone in the bhajan hall about Prem and his life and the gift of his music to devotees everywhere. To quote from the Vision magazine, he sang Ram Nam with every breath, even with his very last one. Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. And my dear friends relates to that, so I will read that as well. Dear friends, three qualities of the Infinite Lord are proclaimed in the Hindu scriptures to be creation, preservation, and destruction. All three of these dynamics are constantly at work, and yet we tend to ignore or are shocked by the last one, the destruction of a thing or the death of a person. There have been many recently who have been deeply affected by the deaths of near and dear ones. It may sound strange to say only recently, since death is always taking place around us, even in the changing of the seasons, the death of leaves and the dying back of plants is ubiquitous. However, it also happens that we take incarnation in groups, and we often leave in the same fashion. And so it is that many souls connected with our spiritual group are now transitioning out. In life, we love to create, start anew, and when something is valued, we love to preserve it. But attachment means that death belongs in an entirely different category. We feel devastated by it. A spiritual view of life can change this so that death or destruction is on equal footing with creation and preservation. It is interesting how Sri Yukteswar describes what we would call death on the higher planes of consciousness. Paramahansa Yogananda writes what resurrected Sri Yukteswar revealed to him about a higher astral being's death, calling it liberation. Quote, joyous astral festivities on the higher astral planes like Hiranyaloka take place when a being is liberated from the astral world through spiritual advancement and is therefore ready to enter the heaven of the causal world. On such occasions, the invisible Heavenly Father and the saints who are merged in Him materialize themselves into bodies of their own choice and join the astral celebration. In order to please His beloved devotee, the Lord takes any desired form. If the devotee worshiped through devotion, he sees God as Divine Mother. To Jesus, the Father aspect of the Infinite One was appealing beyond other conceptions. The individuality with which the Creator has endowed each of His creatures makes every conceivable and inconceivable demand on the Lord's versatility. My Guru and I laughed happily together. What a different conception of what we call death. To celebrate that one's liberation, a graduation party for a work well done. To be aware that death of the body is liberation for the soul into a higher, joyful, and more refined life certainly means we can be happy for the ascending soul, even if we will miss their familiar physical presence. Death is truly a part of all life. Even stars and stellar systems, as well as this entire universe, will have their demise. Therefore, the proper understanding of death is much needed and helps to liberate you even while you are yet residing on earth. Even if you have no faith in the eternal nature of the soul of a loved one, you may experience your unending existence through deepened meditation. When the ego nature dies and your innate divinity is resurrected, there is a clear knowledge of the beginningless, endless nature of spirit, of your soul. In that realization, you know that before you took on a physical body, you were. And after leaving this physical body, you will ever be. Becoming established in this wisdom is the death of death. You are born to eternal life. The intense grief felt at the time of death of a loved one is largely rooted in not knowing the eternal nature of the soul. It is time, even now, to deepen your knowledge of who and what you really are. In that awakening, you remove the fear of death from your life and your attachment to want others to remain in their bodies. In that realized state, you may feel sadness for the loss. Excuse me. In that realized state, you may feel sadness for the loss of familiar aspects of a shared life here on earth. However, the shock of death of a loved one will not separate you from God or the wisdom in knowing that this soul has moved on to a higher existence. Joy will then be interwoven with any sorrow, lifting the burden of a desperate grief. In that realization, you may then say with St. Paul, "So when this corruptible shall have put on incorruption, and this mortal shall put on immortality, then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory?" Death is the one thing that we cannot get around in this life. Everything that is born must die. This is the nature of all of this creation. Even those who have taken on bodily immortality must one day dissolve whatever form they hold. The great Babaji, it is said, at one time took on a kayakalpa, a renewed body. Through a yogic process, he left the body, so to speak, that he was in, and he took on a brand new body, not born from man and woman, but out of his own thought process and through attunement to the divine spirit. But even that form will one day dissolve itself and merge itself into the universal. It is a fascinating subject to think on this idea of death. Some people consider it something that's taboo. You don't talk about it. You don't try to think about it. Death is all around us. It's constantly a part of life, and it's amazing how much we shield our minds from even thinking about death. What is its nature? What happens to us after death? These are essential questions, and the fear of death drives most of humanity in one way or another. It operates in the secret background, and it works as an anxiety about this life, anxiety about holding on to things. The truth is, we can't hold on to anything, and the whole problem, the ignorance of it all, is rooted in the idea that we think that we are this body, because our memories oftentimes don't go back beyond this bodily consciousness in this specific form. Now, this isn't too unusual, because most people have very few memories of when they were 6 or 7 years old or younger. And so that we should not have memories of other lifetimes, we don't even remember properly all of this lifetime. We perhaps have fragment memories of earlier life. God showed me one time my life in the womb of my own mother. And in that experience, I curled up into a ball like I was in a fetal position. And I could hear my mother's heartbeat. And it was very soothing and very warm, very comforting. And I liked it where I was at. And I had some knowledge in my consciousness that I was going to be born into this world. And I had some awareness that there were going to be great difficulties along the way. And I recoiled at it. I didn't want to enter into this world. I wanted to stay exactly where I was. And so that was a very clear experience that came to me, and gradually that experience began to recede into the background, and I uncurled from that fetal position. But it was a very strong memory, an awakening of something that I had once experienced. And it made me know that even those who are in the womb of their mothers carry consciousness with them. They're aware of many things. And souls who are first coming into this world sleep a great deal. And during that sleep, they merge into the astral. And then they spend a short amount of time here in the physical, and then they go back into the astral or the causal, depending on where they came from. And so it is that there's a very gradual transition into this physical body, but it demands so much from us. We have to learn how to feed. We have to learn how to cry out when we're uncomfortable. And gradually we begin to learn the language we're at. Even if you had an incarnation where English was spoken, if it was a few hundred years ago, it'd be such a different variation of English, you probably wouldn't understand much of what was being said here. So you have to attune yourself to all of the things. What are the social norms? What's expected of you? There's so much that absorbs you. There's so much growing that goes on in the body. And as you transition yourself into this body and into this world, so many times all the things of spirit, all the things that you knew coming into this world, fades into the background because you simply don't find it necessary at that moment. Your mind is so taken up with everything else. There are exceptions to this. And there are those who come in, as Master did, with such great awareness and a drive to attain realization. There are very few, such as Anande Moy Ma, who came in with perfect knowledge of who she was in spirit. And actually, she existed for many years in the body before she voluntarily went into a stage of ignorance. And for 7 years, she separated herself from herself. And then she went through all the different sadhanas so that she would know and understand what it was that devotees coming to her were experiencing in their ignorance. And this is the way that Mother came in into this world, is in a state of separation. She said that there are different kinds of realized beings who are incarnated into this world who have no karma of their own. It's not that often that such a soul comes in. But I think this 20th century through the 1900s was such a tremendous time filled with so much danger that there were a number of great, great souls who came in to help with the transition during that time from the Kali Yuga into the Dwapara Yuga, and so that we didn't destroy ourselves, which we destroyed a great deal of ourselves, but the damage could have been much, much worse. And so these great souls came in, and Mother came in as an avataram, as she described it, which is one who is not aware of their divine origin when they come in. And she lived as any other soul would live, only she just felt that she had this tremendous destiny in front of her. She didn't know what it looked like or what it was. But she felt that there is something tremendous for her to do in this lifetime. And when she met her master, she was put onto that path, the path that would take her to her complete and total realization. And so she went through all the different stages. She experienced things as a householder, as a woman, as a mother, that anyone else would. She said, any experience that you've gone through, I've already gone through it. And so she had compassion, she had love, she had understanding for everything that everyone went through. But she was also completely and totally clear on what the true purpose in life was. She broke no nonsense in terms of excuse making. She would say, I, as one little woman, could do it. You can do it too. There's no excuses for you. And that tremendous will that she had, that tremendous dedication to God and Guru, she was so dedicated to her Guru, there's nothing that she wouldn't do for him. And when he left the body, he was left in Mount Washington for some little time so that devotees could come and be with him. And Mother was able to go down and be with him and spent the entire night in meditation with this, what seemingly was an inert and dead body. And as the sun was coming up, she bowed down and she touched her forehead to his stocking-covered feet. And she felt an electric jolt come out of those feet into her third eye point and went throughout her entire body. And just as she was kneeling down at those feet, she told Master that she would do whatever it is that she could do to help him in his work, and would she accept her life as she gave it freely to him? And so that electric shock that came through was, I think, an affirmation that, yes, he did accept her life. And it was just a few years after that that she went into the great Nirvikalpa Samadhi. And in that state, she saw all of this creation, the history of all creation, the history of her own soul and her incarnations. And she saw herself, the first time she came into incarnation in this world, she came as a dewdrop. And I could just see this lovely little dewdrop hanging off of perhaps a rose with the morning sun coming up and shining through it. So brilliant, so beautiful. And so she saw herself as that dewdrop, and that was her first consciousness coming into this material world. It's a fascinating journey that we've been on. God showed me once in deep meditation my first incarnation, and it came in a lava flow. And I could feel myself completely identified with this rock that was in movement, and I was, as it was coming down from the mountain. And it was a wonderful experience. And in that time, your consciousness is not dissociated from God. And so you can feel yourself in spirit, but you feel yourself in consciousness as well. And it begins to entice you. You begin to think, well, wouldn't it be wonderful? What else can I experience here? And so you can move then from mineral and rock formations into vegetation. And it's the next stage in evolution, and it's quite different because there's growth, there's movement, and there's flowering, there's fruit perhaps that comes. And all of that is a brand new experience, and you experience it within your own consciousness. And then you enter into animal life, insect and animal life, and there you gain a new kind of movement. You're able to go from place to place. There's more decision-making that you can make. Will you go this place or that place? Will you seek out your food here or there? It's fairly basic, but it's something that you can experience at the time, and it's brand new. And then finally, as you evolve through all the different animal consciousness and into the mammals, you're finally ready to enter into human consciousness. And the thing that's different about us as human beings is that we have the 6 and 7 chakras that the medulla and at the top of the head that have great potentiality. And that's unique, that we can know God. We can rise above the heart center. The heart center is the mediator between the three lower centers that have strictly to do with body consciousness and then going up into higher consciousness. But this Kali Yuga, as God showed me one time, this time of darkness or of twilight is an excellent time for people to make transitions from animal forms into human forms, because the two are merged and so are close together. So it's in this twilight time that many people come into human consciousness, but when they do so, they're primarily aware of the three lower centers, and they're involved with survival, getting food, meat, drink, whatever it is that they need, enjoying of the senses. And that's what life is for them. They don't think of anything more than that. And even if there's church around or if there's a religious movement around, they may join it because that's what's required of them, but their consciousness is really not awakened to anything higher. And then gradually, the teachings of religion, the teachings of spirituality, begin to awaken within that individual their heart center. And they feel themselves, they grow beyond them their own immediate concerns or their own family concerns. And suddenly their outlook broadens and their compassion reaches out to a greater circle. They begin to serve mankind. They serve God within them. They begin to think of something beyond what they eat, what they drink, the enjoyment of the senses. But it's gradual, the way that it comes. It starts to awaken, and then the individual goes back to sleep into ordinary human consciousness again. Perhaps they have an awakening experience, and it remains with them, but it doesn't really inspire them. Because each soul is compared to a log that has been saturated with dampness. And you try to light a fire to that log, and it just smolders. It just doesn't get going. And really, if you're trying to keep a fire going, you'll take those wet logs, those damp logs, and you'll put them next to the burning fire. And gradually, that log will begin to steam, and as it dries out, it begins to have the potential for bursting into flame. And that is what happens when we come into connection with saints, with spiritual souls, with realized beings. They begin to dry us out, and if we keep in close association with them, if we keep their minds upon the saints, upon the great masters of this world, then gradually the dampness that's been produced by such close association with this world that we've completely forgotten our divine nature, it begins to awaken in us. That spark lands on us, and now we are able to sustain a burn. A fire begins to flame inside of us. It's a spiritual fire. It's a spiritual flame. And when it comes upon us, we will douse it by getting immersed back into the world. And so we forget once again. And then we get into a real miserable spot. And we want to reach out for something higher, something greater. So we do some spiritual practice for a little while. And we get a little bit dried out, and we start to have spiritual experience, and then the world takes us over again. It's back and forth like this for so long. It's amazing that God has such patience, because none of us would be able to make it if he didn't. But gradually, gradually, we begin to get rid of all the dampness produced by this world. And then we become dry timber, and simply a spark landing on us starts a flame, a conflagration that begins to burn and burn, and we don't see any end to it. It's burning away all of the dross, all of the ignorance, everything that keeps us separate from God. And we must go through this. This is the mystical crucifixion. This are the experiences that are required to awaken us. And we spend so long wandering around in ignorance. And just after a little bit of time of God drying us out and then putting us through this purging, we think, oh, it's taking too long. But if we could see and remember the totality of all the experiences, all the lifetimes that we've been through, we would see that it hasn't been that long at all. The time of recovery is much, much shorter than all of the decades, all of the years, all of the lifetimes that we spent wandering away from God. But we have to face those things that we ourselves created in our outward journey from God. This is a tremendous story. And it is the story of every individual, every human being who has taken incarnation, every sentient consciousness that is now in process of making this journey from the material finally to the human, and from the human to the divine. It's a fantastic story. And it is your story as well. And when you come to that time of awakening, you have to treat that flame very, very carefully. Because you can extinguish it. You can actually put it out. When it begins to awaken inside of you, you think that it's the truth. And it has always been true. You can't imagine it not being true. And suddenly you are attached, you're connected with that eternal life. But if you allow, the world will take you back over again, and you'll fall into a complete state of forgetfulness. That is one of the most amazing things that can happen in our journey. And it is something that we must learn to watch out for. We make excuses. We get onto plateaus. We quit working. And when we slow down or stop our sadhana, we coast along for a little while. And we can make excuses for ourselves, but it's like mathematics. If we're not going up, then we're going to go down. There's very little in between. And we start going down and down. We get less and less enthusiastic about our search for God. We start finding other things to get interested in. And then suddenly we find ourselves down in a deep, dark valley. And we feel very sorry for ourselves. We wonder why God has done this to us. Well, of course, God hasn't done it to us at all. We've done it to ourselves. But it is through those experiences, those painful learning experiences, that we finally come to the point where we take responsibility for our own lives. We realize no one else will do it. Many times we suffer the fantasy, well, maybe some great spiritual being like Jesus will just come to this world and straighten it all out. Well, he's already been here. How well did he do? How straightened out is this world? He gave his life for that project. And yet the world goes along on its merry way. Each one of us are a co-creator with God. And we must do our part. We must do our part, because if we do not, then we are helping to spread ignorance. We are helping to spread darkness. And this world will not change. God's grace is constantly flowing to you. This is a great truth that God showed to me. I know our experience feels like suddenly grace descends upon us, and we feel lifted up, and we feel surcharged. We feel as God smiled upon us. Well, what does that mean about the moment before we had that grace? Was God not smiling upon us? No. God is always flowing to us through his grace. But we are the doorkeepers. Jesus said it when he said that I stand at the door and I knock, and to all them who open, I come in and sup with them and they with me. You merge with that Christ consciousness. You enter into it, but who opens the door? It is you. How do you do that? Through your own devotion, through your own love, through your own desire to realize God and God alone. Death is a finality that we cannot escape. And we must learn its secrets here. Many people think, well, when I die, then I'll know all the secrets. Then I'll know all the wisdom. It doesn't work that way. Because your desire nature that's connected with this earth will draw you back here again. Why? Because it's only here that those desires can get worked out. And so it is your attachment that draws you back again and again and again. And it is only here that you can establish your freedom. Death, in that sense, works no great magic. Certainly your consciousness changes because you're free of the material body, but your own desire nature will draw you back into a material body, and when you merge back in, you'll enter back into that same state of forgetfulness. You cannot escape your destiny. So if not now, then when? And if not here, then where? It's always tempting to think that it'll be easier at another time, another stage of life. But it doesn't get easier because your habit nature is what you're fighting. And that's just many more years of adding to your habit nature if you're not changing it now. Lari Mahasha said, get acquainted with God in the springtime of your life. Don't wait till the winter, because it may be too late then. You start your practice now. You deepen it now. You don't go with any excuse making. Certainly there may be those occasions when something interferes with our practice. But really, you can carry on your practice of remembering God no matter what else is going on in your life. So this is the truth. This is the truth. And when you give yourself to God in this way, when you love God, when you're devoted to Him, when you seek Him out with all of your heart, mind, strength, and soul, you will feel God's presence. You will feel that joy. It's always interesting before I come to give a talk, because in that inner state, when God is just speaking to me through His own, my mind is at a complete stillness. And I think to God, I think, you're going to have to think thoughts through me, because I don't have one of my own. You'll have to decide if something is to be said. Otherwise, we'll all just sit in silence, which is all right too. Because in silence, oftentimes, we can hear the Om more easily. But you come to that state, and you hear that Om. As I'm talking to you, I hear it resounding in the back of my head. It's like a wide pipeline that's constantly flowing. It's always with me. And in that Om vibration, what we call Om, is the name, the sound of God. And in it is a complete state of stillness, an inner state of stillness, in which nothing is needed. You need not go anywhere or do anything. But then suddenly you're prompted to go here, to say this, to do that. And it all comes out, and it's all guided exactly by that vibration that's flowing to you and always is, and always has been. And the only difference is whether your door is open or whether it's locked and closed. This is the most tremendous life. The most tremendous life. And God will do with you exactly as He chooses. As I talked about in this dear friend's that day, and I remember the night when we had the bhajan, and God told me to leave my profession and to just strictly serve God in the way that Mother had ordained me to do. And one of my first thoughts was, well, I wonder how that works financially and where will I live? But I didn't have any great fear about it. It was more of a curiosity. And as things unfolded, God just demonstrated one tremendous thing after another. And Peter Schultz built a beautiful little apartment for me in what had been a portion of his garage, and it was, as he does with everything, it was absolutely beautiful. And as one devotee referred to me, the guru in the garage. And so he's taking care of me at every step of the way. And it's beyond my own comprehension. I just sit back in awe and wonder as all of these things unfold. And He will do that for all of us. It's not that you just sit on your hands and wait for God to do something for you. You're an active instrument of His in this world. But when you love Him, when you serve Him, when you give everything over to Him, He will animate you. I wish I could describe, really, how God has taken everything away from me, even my own life, my own breath, my own life energy. And it's been difficult at point times, but what He's shown me in it is that everything comes from Him, even my own life energy, my ability to even move, to breathe, to do anything. To think. You know, many of us are proud of our brains. We may not even know it. But we are. And when God takes away all of your thought, when He can take away all of your memory, anything He chooses to, He shows time and again, it all comes from Him. And it can be disconcerting, particularly when we feel attached to it. But gradually we learn to trust in Him, because whatever thought we need, He gives to us. Whatever action He requires or He desires for us manifests. Now, you can't play fast and loose with this thing. Oh, well, God didn't want me to do this, and it's just really carelessness on your own part. You can't do that. Not really, and stay in tune with God. You must give yourself completely. And when you do, then He takes care of you so perfectly, so beautifully. And if you have a desire that comes in, if you have something that you want, then charge God with manifesting that. You must, if you are creating this through me, God, you must manifest it. You must see to it that it is fulfilled. And then you continue. You don't have to just think on that one subject all the time. But you continue to serve God, to love God, to do everything for Him. And watch Him go to work in your life, in your name. Sometimes we can think that God is very impersonal, but He is not. How could God, who's without a personality, create human beings who are filled with personalities? God must be that first, before it could be manifest. So He is as very personal, as intimate as any feeling, any thought you could ever have. Have you ever thought about it that way? He is manifesting through you, through that feeling, through that idea. And so accept God on that level too, that He is thinking through your own thoughts. He is feeling through your own being. It is the most personal, intimate, beautiful relationship you could possibly imagine. Sometimes people conceive of God as their friend, the friend of friends. Others as a tiny baby, as tiny baby Jesus or tiny baby Krishna. Others as a supreme being, however they conceive that in their own minds. Others as a great spiritual master. You see, as Sri Yukteswar said here, God delights in expressing Himself in any way that the devotee chooses. There are no limits to it. So He may manifest to you as Divine Mother, as Heavenly Father, as great spiritual beings and saints. Isn't that marvelous? Bruce Stevenson sent me a little thing that he saw a bumper sticker and he thought that I had enjoyed. And God is too big to be in just one religion. And it reminded me of the movie of Oh God when John Denver says, but I don't belong to any church or religion. And George Burns, as God said, neither do I. I don't belong just to one church or any one religion. So God is universal, but He's so personal. He's so intimate. He moves. He's the breath behind your own breath, the thought behind your own thought, the feeling behind your own feelings, you see. He is everything. And to separate yourself from any of that is just not accurate. It's not true. Why would you do that to yourself? So let us seek to deepen that intimacy, that personal touch that comes through that God experience. And not distance God from us, as if He's some distant being handing out judgment left, right, and center. He's your very self. And you could not separate yourself from Him even if you wanted to. Now, you can live in a state of separation, but that's different. Even in your state of separation, God is intimately connected and tied with you. Let us have our closing prayer. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet and surrender myself to Thee. I feel the power of thy perfection.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with thee.
Of my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am he.
Blessed Spirit, I am he.
I bow to the light within you.